From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in mid-January in Albany when Governor Andrew Cuomo announced a Green New Deal for New York State. You've certainly heard by now about the federal Green New Deal, a proposal crafted by Democrats in Congress that addresses energy, climate change, and justice. While the plan has been applauded by many climate activists across the nation, it is under fire from the political right and from some members of the Democratic Party, who say it has no chance of passage and is much too non-specific, much too broad. Well, what about New York State's version of a Green New Deal? Governor Cuomo's proposal, outlined in his 2019 Justice Agenda, increases previous green energy goals outlined by the state. It pledges to make all of New York's energy 100% carbon-free by the year 2040, and it enhances wind and solar efforts. Specifically, it quadruples the state's offshore wind target by 2035 and doubles distributed solar deployment by 2025. Projects could break ground as early as August, and some are slated right here in the Rochester and Finger Lakes region. If New York State's Green New Deal passes the legislature, the state would have the most aggressive and legally binding clean energy target in the country. But some climate activists say, okay, that's still not enough. They're calling for even stronger, more immediate action to address climate change. The goal, essentially, is for 100% renewable energy by 2030 and an immediate halt on construction on fossil fuel projects across the state. This hour, we examine New York State's Green New Deal. If passed, what would it accomplish and when? Is it realistic? Is it idealistic? Or does it fall short in addressing the dangers of global warming? Our guests help us answer those questions. Some of them attended the Senate hearings in Albany, and they'll share their reactions on what they've learned not only in Albany, but in studying these various proposals. Joining us in studio is Sue Hughes-Smith, member of the leadership team for the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. She was in Albany for the Senate hearings on the Green New Deal. Welcome back. Thanks for being here, Sue.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Also with us is Heather DeLeese, who is a Greater Rochester parent leader and team coordinator for Irondequoit Mothers Out Front. Welcome back to you. Thanks for being here. In studio with us is Aaron Michaud, who is president of the Metro Justice Council. Aaron, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
Andrew Thomas is a member of the Rochester chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America's Eco-Socialist Working Group and fundraising and membership director at Metro Justice. Andrew, welcome to you.
Thanks very much.
And on the line with us is Mark Dunley, chair of the Green Education and Legal Fund and one of the initial authors of the Green New Deal, who has a lot to say about the current form. Mark, thanks for taking the time.
Well, thank you, Evan, for having us on.
I'm going to start with you, Mark, just because we've read some of your what you've had to say here, and it does not sound like you are one of the top cheerleaders for Governor Cuomo's plan, generally speaking. Fair?
Well, I don't think the Green New Deal goes far enough. I do, however, give, and I've been a big critic, as you probably know, of Governor Cuomo and his climate agenda over the years. I do think that his new proposals, which he calls the Green New Deal, is definitely a step upwards from what he has done before. And I think now, rather than debating whether the governor is committed to climate change, we can, you know, focus on debating how we can go faster. But when we started the Green New Deal, and to be honest, when we started in 2010, we'd be in the Green Party at that point. We were borrowing it from the European Greens, who started it around 2006. And so it does include that real commitment to climate action, emergency mobilization, moving really fast. We initially talked about 2020, now we're talking about 2030. But it also includes the New Deal part, and that's the part that also is missing from what the governor is talking about, because that included basically put into place the Economic Bill of Rights that President FDR did in his last State of the State, which is the right to universal health care like single payer and the right to a living wage job, a guaranteed job, and to housing and education. So the governor's version of the Green New Deal does not talk much about that. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's and Sunrise Movement does talk a lot about that. I do think the governor does deserve credit for stepping up, but we have a lot further to go.
Let me ask the guests in studio for their own thoughts on this, and then we're going to kind of walk through some of the specific ideas and proposals that either the guests feel like are on the mark, perhaps fall short. There's been a lot of publicity about certain aspects of it. Sue Hughes-Smith, you've been in Albany. You've been there for the Senate hearings on the Green New Deal. What did you make of it?
Well, the Senate hearings were actually on specifically the Climate and Community Protection Act. And number one, it was great that the Senate finally has taken up the issue of climate and that they were holding some hearings. There were, I think, over 40 speakers, the vast majority of whom were in favor of climate action and of going faster than the Climate and Community Protection Act lays out. Alicia Barton, I think is how you pronounce her name, for NYSERDA was there, spoke more to Cuomo's vision. And the questioning of her, I thought, was very helpful because Cuomo is very strong about electricity being renewable as opposed to energy. Okay, so under Cuomo's plan, there's no conversation really about transportation or building heating. And while it's great that he wants to make electricity renewable, because all these other sectors really eventually, really quickly, really need to be electrified, that's the biggest gap.
Okay. Let me ask Aaron Michaud for your thoughts as president of the Metro Justice Council. What do you make of the plan so far?
Evan, I would say, similar to what other people have said, that the the governor's proposal is admirable in its approach to renewable energy, but it is lacking in areas that the federal resolution talks about that are really a big part of what climate change is in looking at needs for housing, food shortages, transportation, and healthcare. And another thing that I think is really strong about the federal resolution is that as a resolution, it's part of a conversation. And I think what we really want to be talking about here is how to mobilize as many communities in the New York State area, as well as nationally, to be involved in this effort.
And Aaron, you know, just to follow up on a point you raised there, as you look at the federal resolution, you're right. It includes more ideals, maybe not specifically when it comes to economic justice, healthcare, et cetera, but those are all included in terms of the goals and the mission and the broad definition of what's at stake here for certain. Now, you want to see that on the state level. There have been some self-identified centrist Democrats who've criticized those aspects. They say, you know, Aaron, tell me what healthcare has to do with climate change.
Yeah, there are a few connections. One, and I think the largest one, is that if we're asking people to, first of all, we need to build housing, we need to build public transit and move people into that new housing and that sustainable housing. Those are creating jobs. And if we're asking people to move from the jobs that they're in, particularly possibly in fossil fuel related jobs, from those jobs where they have security and they have benefits to another job, if we're taking in migrants who are fleeing climate devastation in other areas like we have in Rochester with in the Puerto Rican community, then we have to be able to account for the fact that people's health care is usually attached to either the state they live in or the job that they have. And if we're not providing for health care for people, then that's going to be a problem.
Okay. Andrew, go ahead. What did you make of it?
I think sort of to the point about sort of the split in the Democratic Party in particular, I think, I like the fact that the federal bill is sort of idealistic and far-reaching, and it sort of exposes the lie that our hands are tied, right? And I think, again, Governor Cuomo's proposal does a lot to try to push forward sort of an incrementalist project when it comes to the climate justice work that we do. But the Green New Deal federally opens the door for a broader discourse along the lines of the things that Aaron and Mark and everybody are already talking about right now. And it is sort of, when we see Dianne Feinstein or Nancy Pelosi say no and talk down to children, that sort of speaks to where they're coming from. That's part of the problem. Right. The Ocasio-Cortezes and the other insurgent candidates, they say yes, and that's a conversation I think we need to have.
Okay. Heather, go ahead.
Yeah, Governor Cuomo, I mean, he's done a lot, actually, over the last 10 years. He's done other things. Before all this hit, something that he was doing was something called REV, which was reforming the energy vision for New York State, and wanted to get us to 50% renewable electricity and 40% reduction in greenhouse gas. He does mention transportation, and even in his new proposal, he touches on transportation, but doesn't talk about how he's going to do a complete overhaul and electrify transportation, which is what we need to do. And not just public transit, but also school buses. I mean, it is the number one cause of asthma for children is our carbon emissions. Who live predominantly where these kids are having problems are the kids in the city, which is another way that this is connected to healthcare. You know, climate change has caused a healthcare problem, and his proposal does not address healthcare. We need universal healthcare to help keep up with the problems that we have caused other people. And the federal resolution, as stated, is outreaching. We want something loose so that we can come in and make specifics going forward with experts. Cuomo, right now, his proposal, although great, it's really based on plans that were already going forward. And he's packaged it sort of under this nice new term called the Green New Deal. It really doesn't serve us that purpose of getting to where we need to go to net zero in 2030, where the IPCC has already said we need to keep rising levels at 1.5 degrees Celsius now and no longer at 2. And, you know, we're already seeing devastation across our country due to catastrophic storms. This is a real problem, and we can't just say we're going to do things by 2040 and 2035 anymore. We need to hit this by 2030 drastically. And his, you know, coming out and saying he's going to ban plastic bags and double our solar and wind, it's not enough.
Okay, and so is there a danger to celebrating that somebody is doing something for the sake of something, as opposed to saying what's being done needs to be analyzed more thoroughly? Is there a danger to over-celebrating something that's...
Yes.
Yeah?
I think so. We don't want to get people too excited and jump off the bandwagon, because right now he has... It's tricky. He has, obviously, a petition going out. He wants people to sign and saying they're supporting his Green New Deal, and that could send the wrong message. That could say, okay, people are saying this is enough when we know it's not enough. We need to push farther. Right now, just for example, Mothers Out Front, we're going to do a Mothers Mobilization Campaign for Mother's Day, where we want to let the governor know, like, you know, thank you first and foremost for doing what you're doing, but we need more, and this is what we need.
Okay, and I want to turn back to Andrew, if I could, just because, you know, Andrew raised some of the pushback within the Democratic Party on the federal level, whether it was Nancy Pelosi sort of mocking the Green Dream, as she called it, or the well-publicized clip of Senator Dianne Feinstein talking to young students who are voicing concerns. And essentially, to sum up, what she's saying is, you don't get it. You don't get how Washington works. I do. You cannot have everything you want at once. This takes time. And I'll come up with something, because everything else is too idealistic. I mean, I'm not trying to be rude. That's essentially the message. And frankly, Andrew, a lot of people, not a lot, I mean, I don't know how to nebulously describe this, but there's plenty of self-described centrist Democrats, let alone people on the political right, who say she's right, that you can't just waltz into Washington or Albany and say, this must all get done now, because that isn't how it works. There has to be some sort of coalition building, et cetera. And Feinstein had a point there. Now, clearly, you are not in the camp that thinks Senator Feinstein was in the right for what she said there. So realistically, we're not just talking about legislation. We're talking about a cultural change in how politics gets done, either at the state and national level. How does it happen? How is this going to happen?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we talk about climate denial on the right. We also have a certain brand of climate denial in liberal camps, too, right? Like, we don't the existential crisis of the climate threat has not reached some of our centrist Democrats. And I think that's endemic in what they say and do. There's that point. And then, you know, we're not so when you read Governor Cuomo's proposal, it reads a lot like a competition to see who's the most radical progressive on either coast, right? Like, we're going to do this better than California. You had Michael Leidy on last week talking about Medicare for All.
Yeah.
I'd like to echo that point, right? Like, it's not about who's going to do it better than any other progressive to win political points. It's about what we need to survive and to thrive.
Okay. Mark Dunley, do you feel the same? You know, I hesitate to ask you about the Senator Feinstein clip, because I suspect I know where you're going to go with that. But that has been the prevailing political sentiment, no matter who you talk to, with some small exceptions, for years in Washington. This isn't going to happen overnight. Everyone sort of step back and let the professionals handle it and let us compromise. What do you make of that, Mark?
Well, I think back to a few months ago when the New York Times devoted their entire Sunday edition of their magazine to the proposition that we have missed the opportunity to deal with climate change and that life as we know it on this planet will come to an end because it is impossible with our present political leadership to make the changes that are needed. So the New York Times conclusion was, you know, game's up. And I think our response is it's, you know, time to have game on. And, you know, that, you know, as I said, we started the Green New Deal in, you know, 2010. The reality is that, you know, Congressman Ocasio-Cortez and the Sunrise Movement managed to, you know, put that on the front page in, you know, a couple of months and did far more than we've done in 10 years. And that's actually given me hope, and I think it's the young people, for instance, who had that conversation with, you know, Senator Feinstein. I think they're saying we're not taking the answer of politics as usual in Washington, D.C., or at the state capitol. When scientists now actually begin to, you know, give some estimation about the extinction of human species, we're certainly seeing the extinction of most species on the planet right now. I think young people are saying, listen, we want a future. And right now, our political leadership in Albany and in Washington is not working to stand up to the fossil fuel companies and give us a future. And what we're talking about by, you know, a Green New Deal and fast action is full employment, putting people to work, lowering electric bills compared to reliance upon fossil fuels, and stop killing people from air pollution. I mean, 3,000 to 5,000 people a year just in New York die from health problems related to air pollution. We cannot do politics as usual. We have to change it. One other point I did wanted to add, we haven't really mentioned much about the issue of stopping fossil fuels. We have the need to immediately stop all new fossil fuel infrastructure. And unfortunately, for some reason, that's not something that's in the Sunrise Movement proposal, and it's not been something the government is willing to do. And one of the problems we have seen across the planet is even as we have significantly increased the percentage, other than in New York State, of the amount of electricity being provided by renewables, the greenhouse gas emissions have continued to increase. So yes, we must move to job-producing renewable energy as soon as possible, but we must also immediately halt, you know, our use of fossil fuels, and that begins with saying no to any new fossil fuel infrastructure.
So there's Mark Dunley, chair of the Green Education and Legal Fund, talking about what's not in state proposals that should be. Let's talk about what is in there. Sue Hughes-Smith, we mentioned off the top here, big new targets when it comes to wind and significant increasing of solar resources. Let's start with those two. Enough on those two scores?
Well, I mean, I think if you could achieve 70% of the electricity coming from renewable sources by 2030, we would be headed in the right direction in a really strong way. As Mark was alluding to, despite Cuomo's, you know, goals over the last however many years he's been in office, we're not really making much progress on the amount of renewables that's being put on the grid. It is really, really, really slow. I mean, you can claim 1,000% increase in solar, but if you're starting at like 0.00000, I mean, that's not really much of an actual change of kilowatt hours, right? So it's clear that we have a very difficult road ahead of us in terms of mobilizing our communities and accepting people needing to accept that we have to have large-scale renewable energy come online. We have to have people stop fighting every project that gets proposed. And the state could go about that in a number of different ways, but our current system is fatally slow.
What do you think the fighting is coming from? I know you've been, not only have you worked on some of these issues, but you are in touch with a number of people in different causes who work in communities where, for example, wind projects are proposed. Mm-hmm. There is often significant local opposition. Mm-hmm. Some of that is what we would call NIMBYism, and I don't want to be dismissive or flippant. I'm just saying that happens. Mm-hmm. But is some of it, you know, a lack of public education that, look, this is serious now. I mean, this is, we're going to live in a world with big wind farms, and we're going to need them. And that's like that's going to be what we have to do here.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, in communities where people are benefiting personally and as a community from those wind projects, there's really not as much opposition. I have a student right now who comes, you know, from further north in New York. Her community loves the wind turbines. I had a student once whose college education was being paid for by the rent his family was getting for hosting a wind turbine. You know, we have a very vocal minority in many places that are interested in maybe preserving their view or, you know, preserving the value, what they perceive as the value of their property. And they are so, become so well-funded and so vocal that it squeezes out the voice of other people who are in favor of these projects. And a lot of these projects stand to support communities by providing, you know, real benefits that would help them grow and thrive.
So so that's a little bit on the wind side. It sounds to me like we can anticipate there will be some opposition, though, as mm-hmm. Steve Orr in the Democrat and Chronicle and others have reported, very different responses from different communities. It's interesting. It's not uniform. Mm-hmm. There are some communities that are very much welcoming these ideas, and some there's a little bit more mobilized opposition. So we'll mm-hmm. have to see there. But if the proposals that are out there happen, you seem to say, okay, that moves us in a better direction. What about solar farms? I mean, we've seen a lot mm-hmm. in the way of solar farms. How do you feel about that, Sue?
How do I feel about solar farms?
I know you like solar farms.
Right.
How do you feel about the action the state's taking? Is it enough in terms of the proposals you've seen?
I think the goal of 70% of renewables by 2030 is an ambitious goal. I think the state needs to recognize, and that's not at all clear to me, that the total amount of electricity being produced and used needs to about double if we're transitioning all of our heating and all of our cars onto electricity. So I like seeing goals set as percentages. I'm hoping that the governor has in mind the actual gigawatts.
He's got some very smart people around him, I would think.
Definitely. So, you know, we'll see. And to be 100% carbon free by 2040 means that there's a reality that we need to maintain at least some nuclear for some period of time. And that has, you know, split environmentalists feel differently about that issue in particular. Personally, I think we have to keep nuclear until we get rid of all the fossil fuels, and then let's come back to revisit that question. But let's not use that as a stumbling block right now.
I want to turn to Aaron Michaud, who's president of the Metro Justice Council, because the governor's proposal, he has what he calls a 2019 justice agenda and has worked to promote some of these actions as being in conjunction with one another. Again, as you have mentioned sort of from the outset here, maybe not as comprehensively as we've seen in the ambitious Green New Deal on the federal level. Do you think that the governor and his team that has proposed some of these ideas does have justice in mind as a framework?
I believe so, Evan, but I think that he has not, because if we're only looking at renewable energy as what this problem is, then I don't think that we've taken into account enough the scope of the issue, because I think, and I think to touch on some of the things that Sue said, one of the issues at the state level, this is a top-down production, and I think if we're talking about transforming communities, even if we're just talking about energy, then we have to be talking about what the community input has, you know, the community input into that process, and also what the incentives are for that community and who benefits. And so I know that there are environmental justice proposals within the governor's plan, but I think that in not looking at the scope of this, for an example, most of the communities of color, most of the migrant communities in New York State are dealing with issues where they're not necessarily owning property. So their interest in whether there's solar on properties that people don't own or otherwise don't feel secure in or don't have a long-term interest in is going to be different than in a community where everybody owns their homes and they plan to be there for another 10 years. So I think we have to look at the scope of what we're talking about with climate change, and to only look at the renewable energy, especially from the state level, we're going to be missing a lot of communities of color.
Okay. Andrew Thomas, who is a member of the Rochester chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America's Eco-Socialist Working Group. Is there anything in this proposal that you say, well, at least he got this right?
I think the general thrust of the proposal is right insofar as it's incremental. But I do want to sort of double back on what Sue was talking about with regard to like the actual metrics and what we're actually talking about in terms of scope, right? Like, I think the governor's proposal aims to have enough renewable energy stored annually to power 550,000 homes. But like, there are 8 million homes in New York. we're not even close. Mm-hmm. The proposal calls for the creation of 2,600 short-term and long-term jobs, but there are 472,000 unemployed people in New York State. I mean, and again, to Aaron's point, we're not dealing with the broader scope of this issue. And the proposal aims to spend about $1.5 billion. It sounds like a lot of money, but like, we could be taking advantage of the stock transfer refund, which, you know, was added back in like 1981, and we could be generating $16 billion in new revenue to pay for it. So in New York State. Now, there's other proposals at the federal level, too, that we could talk about. But I think there is a lot that's admirable in the proposal. But from a justice angle, I think it's significantly lacking.
Well, I have some feedback from listeners, and let me read an email, and then we'll take some phone calls. Michelle in Rochester says, I have become a single-issue voter. Whoever adopts the most aggressive stance on addressing climate change will get my vote. No one told Kennedy that you can't have everything at once when he declared we would reach the moon by the end of a decade. Articulating your goal is not synonymous with instant gratification. It's about clear and accurate articulation of the stakes, and no one should get away with denying the seriousness of what's coming and the urgency of action. That is from Michelle. On that subject, Mark Dunley, you know, you've been working on this for many years. I still think there's something that's abstract in the public's mind. In our second hour today, we'll address this a little bit more. But in terms of the urgency of this, I don't mean to be sort of overly cinematic about this, but if there really were a massive asteroid that we knew were coming here by, pick a year, nobody would be celebrating if we said, well, we built a shallow bunker and, 4% of the people who go into it might survive. So, we're not going to be able to compromise in actually trying to blow this thing up before it gets here. But at the very least, a small amount of us might survive. And isn't that nice? And now let's talk about something else. It would be much more obvious and urgent. And the whole old paradigm of how things get done in politics would probably be set aside based on the urgency. And Mark, so much of the argument that you and your colleagues make is that we have that urgency, or we should have that urgency now, but we mostly don't in the halls of power in this country. Is it just because it's a little more abstract than a meteor coming at us? Is it just too abstract for people to get their head around, you think?
Well, I think you also see a big difference between politicians who receive campaign contributions from the fossil fuel industry and those who do not. I do think the fact that the IPCC put out a report, and the IPCC, by the way, is overly conservative and has always been wrong about how fast climate change is occurring. But when they said 12 years, that seemed to generate a little bit more of a concern both among politicians and among the general public. But then I think the extreme weather, that when people saw, the residents of Puerto Rico, which, believe it or not, is part of the United States, going without electricity for, half the year, almost half the population without water, that seemed to give a sense of urgency.
Well, and unfortunately, to Mark's point there, in our second hour, we're going to discuss how extreme weather, which is often tied pretty directly to climate in terms of the extreme events and the higher precipitation events, it doesn't take long for people to feel like, oh, well, that used to be extreme. It's just normal now. And that's a big problem in terms of a public mindset. That's the subject of our second hour. But I take Mark's point that we are at least seeing more impacts now here, that people are feeling like it's real now. But Robert in Fairport wants to weigh in with some questions about some of the pragmatism of these approaches, particularly in regards to electric vehicles. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm kind of curious how this group proposes to get around the natural limitations of electricity, to try to power a vehicle at least. AAA did a study last month that found that when the temperature outside was 20 degrees or colder, that electric-powered vehicles lost over 40% of their driving range. And I don't know how you get around that. And the other thing is I'd like to hear, just go around the room and see what source of energy these people use to heat their homes.
Sure, I'll start.
Oh, so, yeah. Okay, Robert, thank you. You jumped right on that. So.
Robert, those are great questions. And my husband and I invested in a heat pump. It's a geothermal heat pump for our house about 3 years ago now. And we stay toasty warm through our Rochester winters by using electricity that powers that heat pump. In terms of a justice issue, I think it is problematic that these are expensive, and we're going to have to find a way to finance that so more people can access these newer technologies. But there are also air source heat pumps that are less expensive, not as long lasting, but that can also function in our winters. We bought a used electric car, so we bought a used Leaf. And you're right, we get fewer miles in the winter on a charge. But to be honest, most of our driving is within 10 to 15 miles of our house. And thankfully, a lot of communities have now put in charging stations. So it's possible for us to do almost everything we need to do with our electric car. Are we driving to visit our family in Michigan in it? No, we're not. And, maybe those technologies, maybe I'll be able to afford a Tesla someday, or maybe those will become more accessible, or we'll have better public transit. But you're right. There are some current limitations to accessibility from the electric vehicles. And maybe we want to be shifting to some hydrogen fuel cell technologies. And that's certainly a possibility if it's the hydrogen is coming from renewable sources like water.
I saw Andrew wanted to weigh in. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate the caller's question, but I think the focus on individualist sort of efforts to mitigate their own consumption sort of misses the point. Like, as somebody who can't afford a heat pump or an electric car, right, there are bigger issues at play than what is the IPCC report says 70% of all emissions are coming from the, top 100 companies around the world. So focusing on individuals is a distraction, in my opinion. And, at this point, total and complete renewal of our industries and society is the most practical thing we can do. Without a shift to an all-encompassing action, everything else is moot. There's no economy on a planet that's uninhabitable for humans.
Okay. Robert, thank you for that. I appreciate the phone call. I'm going to take our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back. We're going to talk more specifics in terms of what our panelists want to see New York State to do. And generally what you're hearing is an agreement that while laudable in some ways, the governor and the state's proposals do not go far enough. And so what does it look like? How do we move that needle if they could convince Governor Cuomo's office or others to make big changes? What would our panelists do? And we'll talk about that. We'll also get more of your feedback as we continue talking about New York State's version of a Green New Deal. Coming up in our second hour, we continue on the theme of climate with a concerning new study. The study finds that in just 2 years, human beings can change their viewpoints on extreme weather. What we used to think of as extreme or dangerous or deadly, in just 2 years, we can start to think, well, that's normal. That's how it is. And that can demotivate the idea that we need to take action on climate. So what do we do about that? We'll talk about it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Five panelists all talking about state proposals, because at the federal level, you're going to continue to hear a lot about the Green New Deal. But realistically, with the political calculation in Washington, might be a while before anything could pass. I don't know. I mean, urgent times call for urgent measures, and maybe things will change there. But New York State has some of its own proposals. That's what we're discussing. And one of our listeners emailed to say there's a lot of talk about what people don't like. What do they like, or what do they want to see done? Mark Dunley, I'll start with you. You're crafting your own proposal here. What needs to happen now for a New York State Green New Deal that you're not seeing?
Well, one thing I should mention, there is actually a New York State Green New Deal proposal that was introduced by Senator James Sanders and Assemblymember Felix Ortiz, which basically mirrors what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez had initially proposed. And, of course, we had the New York Off Fossil Fuels Act, which would stop all new fossil fuel infrastructure and go to 100% clean energy. What the governor has proposed in his budget, and to a large extent what the CCPA does, other than they did add on, which is excellent, the stuff about the just transition and environmental justice, is to implement a 2009 executive order that actually my wife wrote. She was the environmental person for both Governor Spitzer and then Governor Patterson. And, you know, we need to move from the 2050 to the 2030. But one of the things she points out to me is, I know you guys want to debate 2050 versus 2030. The real issue is, what are these guys going to do in 2020, in 2021, and 2022? You need very short-term specific steps to be taken, because New York State, starting with Governor Pataki, has been miserable and actually meeting the goals that have been established by all four of these governors to take action on climate change. The reality is, after 15 years and billions of dollars, we get less than 5% of our state electricity, which is only about a quarter of the state's carbon footprint, from renewable energy, and we're doing worse with transportation and with buildings. We need clear plans with timelines and benchmarks every other year to be measured. We need annual reports. And bottom line, we need more money. I mean, and I think, as other people have said, we need to really speed up the siting of large-scale renewables. It's almost impossible to site large wind farms and solar farms in New York State. It can often take a decade. And that goes back to the point that other people made. We need to involve local people right at the start in that planning process. And one of the things our Off Fossil Fuels Act bills, and not only requires the state to develop very strong climate detailed action plans, but it also requires each county and every municipality of more than 50,000 people to do that. And citizens have to have the right to go into court and sue our elected officials when they fail to implement it. This is how California did it, and that has made a real big difference. California is going to hit 50% of their electricity from renewable energy by 2030. I'm sorry, by 2020. Their goal was 2030. They're coming in 10 years early. We're probably going to be 10 years late. We need not only to set goals, but we need to put mechanisms into place to do it. But as several people have said, we also have to make it clear that everybody's going to benefit from this. This is going to help, you know, create jobs for people. It's going to reduce pollution, particularly in, you know, disadvantaged communities. People have to feel that they're going to be helped by the solution. And, you know, we saw that in France with the, I think it's called the Yellow Jackets movement, but, you know, they just felt that their government was not paying attention to the average person needs, only paying attention to the wealthy, and so they fought back. We have to ensure that everybody is going to benefit from a transition to a carbon-free economy. And as even Pope Francis said in his Labor encyclical, the reason why we exploit the environment is the same reason that the rich exploit the poor, and that men exploit the women, and big nations exploit small nations. We need real justice to be the center part of any successful climate action plan. And that's the whole point of the Green New Deal. You got to do both at the same time to make this work.
Well, and I heard earlier this hour on the subject, to answer Greg's email on what are the specifics that you do want, Heather mentioned transportation be much more central or even really included at all in what Governor Cuomo and New York State might do here. What are some things that come to mind? Is that top of the list for you that's not there that you do want to see included? Is it something else, maybe?
Oh, there's several things. Transportation is definitely up there because I know it's a huge chunk of the pie. And so, and that helps people like us who can't afford electric vehicles be able to utilize public transportation. We need an overhaul of our entire public transportation system all over New York State. The more public transportation we can provide, and then that public transportation be electrified, the less pressure that's on us as individuals to have to find ways to be better with our carbon footprint. Another one is, I think, healthcare. We all struggle trying to pay for healthcare. I mean, even if you have great coverage, you're paying a lot of money, or your job is paying a lot of money for that coverage, which hurts your paycheck. You might think you're getting great savings, but if your company's paying a lot to give you great coverage, you're going to get less of an annual increase. And maybe that's what's going on. I mean, we've been at a standstill.
But again, tie this to climate for me.
Because if we have more money in our pockets, we can make better choices. Right now, we don't have more money in our pockets, so we're taking advantage of things. It's cheaper to buy fuel right now in some cases, and it's cheaper to buy a car that's not electric. So we need more money in our pockets, and the state needs more money in their pockets. So that is definitely directly related to healthcare and the healthcare prices. We also need better education. It's been mentioned, free higher education, and part of the reason why we individuals don't understand or grasp what's going on right now is because they are not educated enough in it. Our public schools, even at the elementary level, are not teaching kids about climate change and what the real realities of climate change are. And our universities aren't doing it in liberal arts as a basic study, and it should be at this point. So if we have more education and we have more money in our pockets and we're spending money on renewables and we're healthy, we can move forward as a culture in a more healthy direction for our environment.
I think Heather makes a point that she really articulates a point, really crystallizes a point that comes up, at least in my mind, a lot, and that tied to what Aaron Michaud was saying earlier, which is that, essentially, if we acknowledge, even if we acknowledge civilizationally that we have to deal with this, people who are living in poverty, you can't expect people living in poverty, struggling every single day just to provide, to eat, to find shelter, to be thinking about climate change. I mean, survival is at the top of that. And so economic inequality prevents big parts of our population from even being part of, I think, solutions work. And so I think Heather articulating why even healthcare may matter might be a way to kind of tie in there. You agree there, Aaron?
I do. And I think it goes back to what we were saying about perception of the problem. It's true, on the one hand, what you're saying about if you're dealing with survival on a day-to-day level, you're not thinking about climate change. But it's also true that people who are poor are the people who are most vulnerable in these situations. I mean, if we look at the outcome of, for example, the Katrina storm in 2005 or the Sandy storm, we see that that low-income people are usually displaced in these situations, but they're not able to come back. I think one of the things that I would add to what Heather said in terms of what needs to be done at the state level is housing. I mean, housing is a major source of emissions right now, and we already have a shortage of affordable housing. So there needs to be a massive increase in housing at the state level. And so, I agree with you completely. This is very much an issue of class and race, because for people who have the ability to move, to buy a new house, to get a new job, they're not going to feel the effects of climate change, to pay more money for food. They're not going to feel climate change as much as people who can't.
You want to add to that, Andrew? Go ahead.
Yeah, and I think in the circles of RPCC, we talk about this in dealing with the issues of climate change in terms of mitigation and adaptation, right? So one of the things that the DSA eco-socialist platform emphasizes is the decommodifying of the things we need to survive the climate crisis, which means living wages for all, healthcare for all, childcare for all, housing, food, water, energy, public transit, free pre-K through college education, and healthy environment. All of these things that we need to survive, right? These things are human rights. And if we're not bundling them into a Green New Deal, it leaves open the possibility, particularly in financing it, right? Opportunities for whittling it away and not, and entering into these sort of like financial burdens on the working and poor people for balancing the fight.
So let me ask all of you before the hour is up then, if New York State's version of a Green New Deal as proposed by Governor Cuomo is an example of a car speeding toward a cliff at 60 miles an hour and slowing the car down to 20 or 30 miles an hour, but still heading toward that cliff. I take the point that it's not enough in the way that you have framed it in various ways this hour, assuming your informed views are accurate. What are you going to do now? Because I suspect if this passes in any form, New York State's going to lock into this, and this is going to be what we're dealing with in terms of a framework for a long time. I don't know, but it's not likely to be the kind of thing where they're going to declare victory that this passes and then next year say, you know, let's reset those targets. Let's reset those goals. So what are you going to do? And I'll ask all five of you. Mark Dunley, what happens next year?
Well, Evan, I wish you'd come to the state capitol and talk to some of the state legislators, because they argue the opposite, and I agree more with you. They say, oh, well, let's just pass the CCPA now, and then we'll make it stronger in the future.
Okay, I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm just saying historically, if you look at politics, it doesn't usually happen that way.
And that's what I tell them. And I say, once you guys deal with something, getting you to come back in 5 or 10 years is going to be very difficult. You know, I'm thinking if they actually end up signing the bill, which I hope they don't do as it's written, that they improve it. You know, maybe I come and applaud and then also get arrested at the, you know, bill signing ceremony for not saying enough. You know, you got to just keep on educating people. But, you know, this is something that we need all level of governments to do. And so, you know, you get the state, but you can also work at the town level, the county level. I know that Sue in Rochester is working on community choice aggregation to try to give us more direct control over our energy supply, you know, locally, you know, trying to build out community solar farms. And one thing about community solar farms, that can lower electric bills for low and moderate income mm-hmm. people. So I think whatever happens, we have to work really hard on implementation, and nothing will be solved with no matter what they do. It will not be enough, and we're going to have to continue to push harder.
Okay, so what are you going to do?
Well, much echoing Mark's thoughts, whatever gets passed is likely not to be enough, and we have to keep pressing forward. We absolutely have to have a halt to all new fossil fuel infrastructure. We can't concede any more ground on that point. And keep working within local communities to make their goals more aggressive. And the funding piece has got to get addressed. If the state, you know, the state has a choice of either setting tight regulations and providing a mechanism for massive private investment into the things we need, or they need to, you know, get the money off of the penny per trade at the stock market or something such that will yield billions of dollars that could be used to get this work done.
Okay. Heather?
I work with Mothers Out Front, which is a climate action group for mothers and others, and we are pushing and using our voices to get local leaders on whether it's a municipal level and our government, like their governor and state level, to transition off fossil fuels in 10 years by 2030, and we'll continue to do that. I also urge people and work with other organizations. We want a federal Green New Deal. This is going to hold states accountable to what they can't come up with on their own. So right now, HRES 109 is in Congress, and it has 89 co-sponsors. But right now, our Congressman Joe Morelli is missing. So we have work to do, and they need to hear from us. SRES 59, which is the same bill in our Senate, only has 11 co-sponsors, one of them including Kirsten Gillibrand, and we thank her for that, but not Chuck Schumer. So our senators and congresspeople need to hear from us. We need to let them know, because as millennials and Generation X clump together, we make up the majority of the constituency, and we all want the same thing. And guess what? You got to listen to us. Sorry, Nancy Pelosi.
Andrew and Aaron, about 30 seconds apiece. Go ahead, Aaron.
Yeah, I would say that we would applaud everything that's good about what passes in New York State and then keep working on the other pieces of it. We're a big supporter of the New York Health Act. So, and then also at the federal level, supporting the Green New Deal. I mean, ultimately, this is a global issue, and so we're not going to solve it at the state level, so we just keep working.
Okay. Andrew Thomas.
I think sort of your asteroid analogy, right? I think the building of the bunkers is what I'm looking out for, is when our elected officials on the right start making those types of proposals, right, calling them out for it. It's like in France trying to balance their fossil fuel economy on the backs of the poor and the working people, and then leading an uprising against that. I think that's what we're looking at.
Andrew is a member of the Rochester chapter of the Democratic Socialist of America's Eco-Socialist Working Group and fundraising and membership director at Metro Justice. Thanks for being here.
Thanks very much.
Aaron Michaud is president of the Metro Justice Council. Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you, Evan.
Thanks for taking the time. Our thanks to Heather DeLeese, Greater Rochester Parent Leader and Team Coordinator for Irondequoit Mothers Out Front. Thank you.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Mark Dunley, chair of the Green Education and Legal Fund and one of the initial authors of the Green New Deal and a big critic of what we're seeing now. We always appreciate the time, Mark. Thanks. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Evan.
And we are not letting Sue Hugh Smith go. She's a member of the leadership team for the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. She joins us next hour as part of a panel discussing a disconcerting new study that essentially says this. It takes human beings about 2 years, that's it, to decide that in extreme, say, weather event, extreme weather patterns are just normal now. And if that normalizes, the urgency to change it and to deal with it might go away. We're going to talk about what we do about that next hour.